This is Monday, June 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming your way, new developments in the wake of this weekend's terrorist attack in London. We'll check in with VOA's Jamie Detmer, who's there. The British Prime Minister says there must be change in the way social media allows terrorist hate to spread.
We need to work with allied democratic governments to reach international agreements that regulate cyberspace, to prevent the spread of extremist and terrorism planning.
Also ahead, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, the UAE, Yemen, and the Maldives cut diplomatic ties with Qatar, accusing it of supporting terrorism. All on today's International Edition. The British Prime Minister Theresa May said Monday the police do know the identities of the three attackers who killed seven people and wounded more than 50 others Saturday in London. May said their names would be released when progress in the investigation permits and that authorities were holding 11 people in custody in connection with a probe. She said police are also still working to determine the identities of all of the victims, but that as so far is known, they include people of several nationalities. She said this was an attack on London and the United Kingdom, but it was also an attack on the free world. London police did carry out more raids Monday and detained a number of people during searches at locations in the Newham and Barking areas. May said Sunday that three terrorist attacks in Britain in the past 3 months are bound together by the evil ideology of Islamist extremism.
The UK has led the world in developing a strategy for preventing violent extremism, and it has been highly successful. And we are leading international efforts to take on and defeat the ideology of Islamist extremism around the world. But as the threat evolves, our response must do so too. We cannot go on as we are. Enough is enough.
VOA's Jamie Detmer is on the line with us from London. Jamie, what's the latest on the ongoing investigation?
Well, the numbers, I think, are higher than 11. The Prime Minister said 11. But 11, we know that there were 12 people actually detained at the weekend. One was let go. They're not giving out the numbers of the people they detained this morning in early morning raids, which disturbed neighbours, actually, because they obviously blew doors off, so people heard explosions. So I think the numbers could be higher. We're all a little bemused that they're not giving out the names of the assailants. I mean, we all actually know them. The press know them. We're all observing a silence on names because we've been asked to for operational reasons. But it's quite clear that anyone who's in any way connected to them will know who they are as well. So it's slightly bemusing that we don't have the release of the names yet.
What seemed to be either the areas or the targets of these other raids? Is it families? Is it people they think that are somehow associated with them in other ways? What do you hear and what do you know?
They seem to be mainly family members or friends. I mean, kinship networks. We do know, of course, that kinship networks and friendship networks are crucial in the whole recruitment thing. But there are also a lot of question marks about what preceded this attack in terms of what knowledge the security services had beforehand. The police, of course, are being praised hugely for their operation on Saturday night. In 8 minutes from the alarm being raised, they had actually shot the three assailants. It's a pretty dramatic and quick and swift response. But there are questions about the security services in terms of their prioritizing which militants to keep a thorough eye on. The ringleader of this attack on Saturday was known to them. He had been reported both by an Italian neighbor as well as by a friend because of his extremism, because of trying to proselytize the children in a local park. He appeared on a documentary last summer by Channel 4 News in the UK, unfurling an Islamic State banner in a local park as well. We do know there was some surveillance operation from a report in the Telegraph of a group of militants who were planning some kind of van and knife attack, but it doesn't look to me to be the same group. So there's criticism that they may have missed opportunities to have thwarted this attack on Saturday, and it follows criticism about the Manchester bomber as well, who they also had been tipped off about several times in the years preceding his bombing.
Well, the UK does have an election coming up just in days. How has this and other attacks affected that? And we're quick running out of time, unfortunately. So if you could make that real short, I'd appreciate it.
Everyone is completely unsure how this will impact. On the face of it, it should help Theresa May. She comes across as a strong leader, or has tried to during this election campaign. Generally, conservative and law and order parties do well after mayhem and slaughter. But that didn't hold in France in April, when Emmanuel Macron still beat off emphatically the far-right candidate. And it didn't work in Spain in 2004, when the socialists won an election against the ruling conservatives. So no one is having a guess about how this will impact.
All right, Jamie Dentmer joining us live from London. We appreciate it. We'll speak again real soon. Thanks, Jamie.
Thanks very much.
Joining us now is VOA's White House correspondent, Steve Herman. And Steve, President Trump made some tweets, or wrote out some tweets, overnight and last night that is causing some concern in Great Britain. What did those tweets have to say?
Well, the president sort of doubled down on Twitter on Monday morning with the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan. Now, the president over the weekend and then again on Monday is essentially criticizing the mayor for making a statement, quote, no reason to be alarmed. But what the mayor actually said, there was no reason to be alarmed about an increased police presence on the streets of London. It was not in reference to the attacks themselves, but the president seems to have missed that part of the statement and has continued to criticize the London mayor.
And also, there was something dealing with almost redirecting the whole London, or at least portions of the London attack story, to a plea by the president for the Supreme Court to do something as far as his travel ban is concerned.
Yes, he was criticizing the Justice Department and the courts for not acting on this. Of course, this is now going to the Supreme Court for a hearing at some point. But in his first tweet of Monday morning, the president said, people, the lawyers, and the courts can call it whatever they want, but I am calling it what we need and what it is, a travel ban, exclamation mark, with travel ban in caps. And then he said the Justice Department should have stayed with the original travel ban, not what he called a watered-down, politically correct version. But, of course, that's something that the president signed off on. And then he said the Justice Department, which the president controls, should ask for an expedited hearing of the, as he puts it, watered-down travel ban before the Supreme Court and, quote, seek much tougher version, exclamation mark. And then he went on about extreme vetting again, saying that this is something that we, meaning the United States, is already doing for people coming into the United States in order to keep the country safe. And then another blast at the judicial system, saying, quote, the courts are slow and political. So really a lot of focus on this morning. And Ira, this was supposed to be Infrastructure Week at the White House. A lot of events planned, including one we just attended in the East Room. And now the focus has been taken away from that by the president of the United States himself with his activity on Twitter.
VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman joining us from the White House. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome, Ira.
Among the top stories in the world, the British Prime Minister says police now do know the identities of the three attackers who killed seven people and wounded more than 50 others Saturday in London. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Yemen, and the Maldives cut diplomatic ties Monday with Qatar, accusing it of supporting terrorism. President Trump has proposed privatizing the nation's air traffic control system, part of a week of events focusing on infrastructure. Hundreds of protesters gathered Sunday in the northwestern U.S. city of Portland, Oregon, for rallies for and against President Donald Trump. Philippine opposition lawmakers petitioned the Supreme Court to review and nullify President Rodrigo Duterte's imposition of martial law in the southern third of the country. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. We continue on International Edition from VOA. British Prime Minister Theresa May's call for international regulation of internet-based services to weed out terrorist web warfare was met with both enthusiasm and some skepticism. In a speech yesterday, May said the UK cannot allow extremist ideology the safe space it needs to breathe. She said, yet that is precisely what the internet and the big companies that provide internet-based services provide.
We need to work with allied democratic governments to reach international agreements that regulate cyberspace to prevent the spread of extremist and terrorism planning.
We welcome to International Edition Dr. Alexandra Melligrew-Hitchens, Research Director of the Program on Extremism at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C., and also with me is International Edition social media guru Andrew Palczewski. Dr. Hitchens, thanks for being with us. How are extremist organizations using social media?
Well, there's a number of ways that they're using it. I mean, firstly, it is just to disseminate propaganda, just to put the messages out there and hope that they stick. It's also a way of offering a sort of direct engagement with potential recruits in a way that perhaps wasn't as easy in the past and was much easier to trace. So potential recruits can feel much closer to actual terror leaders or terrorists in IS-held territory or other extremist groups. It also offers, and this touches on what Prime Minister May spoke about, much more recently it offers encrypted messaging technology, which allows people to have more detailed conversations with actual members of IS or other jihadist groups about potential terrorist attacks. They can receive advice. And tactical and strategic advice as well on committing attacks, knowing that their conversations will not be seen by the state.
Is there any way to determine how effective this has been, except from the number of attacks?
Well, look, I mean, we know that in the vast majority of recent attacks, you know, the internet, social media has played some role. Of course, that shouldn't be a surprise. Decades ago, it wouldn't have been surprising to hear that, you know, terrorists and their recruits used other forms of communications like, you know, telephones. I mean, the fact is it's the primary mode of communication. Of course, they're going to use it. You know, and it's going to be impossible to completely control their use of it unless we want to really reevaluate, you know, what we define as a privacy in the sort of liberal democratic world.
Andrew, any questions for Dr. Hitchens?
Yes, Dr. Hitchens, I was wondering what the UK might be able to do as a result of this situation. You have Theresa May saying that the internet companies need to be more accountable, and you have instances where entities like the European Union are partnering with social media companies to try to address hate speech and extremism. What can the UK do, and what can just the world generally do working with these social media companies?
Well, what we've seen is pressure being exerted on social media companies to begin identifying and removing extremists from their platforms. Twitter, I think most recently, has released figures where it has shut down thousands and thousands of pro-IS accounts. And really what the UK want right now is essentially they seem to be asking for access to encrypted messaging chats. So they want to have a sort of backdoor access to what is really private conversations. And actually that sounds like it's not really going to happen anytime soon. Telegram, one of the main encrypted messaging social media platforms, has made it clear it doesn't intend to do that. And it says, it also notes that if you create a backdoor access to encrypted conversations, it's not just states that can use it. Eventually, any hacker will find that backdoor. And so it's not really a solution that's going to work. Now, in terms of giving them the government access to encrypted conversations post-fact, so after the event, that's a more of a realistic discussion that can be had.
Dr. Hitchens, when you talk about the back and forth between social media companies and governments, it reminds me here in the U.S. of the case in San Bernardino, California, where there was a mass shooting and investigators wanted access to the shooter's phone. And it created a legal back and forth between tech companies, social media companies, and the U.S. government. Do you think this is the new fight we're going to see going forward, this back and forth between social media companies and governments looking to shut down this information? And how does that resolve itself?
Yeah, I think the post-San Bernardino law, you know, sort of case between the U.S. government and Apple was a watershed moment and a sort of defining moment for how we're likely to see this play out. There will be tension between tech companies who want to protect their customers, want to protect their bottom line, protect their terms of service, and governments who want to protect their citizens and be seen to be doing something about, this increasing terrorist threat. So I think, unfortunately, one of the things we're going to see is this tug of war, both between governments and tech companies, and also the ongoing tug of war between protecting civil liberties and keeping states secure. And I think, in the end, states, companies, and the general population are going to have to make a decision on, what they value more. Is it preserving, privacy and these kind of rights, or is it increasing security? Also, how does the internet change? What are values that have long preceded the existence of the internet? How does that change maybe our view about free speech, freedom of association, and things like that?
It gets involved and complicated after a while, doesn't it?
It gets very complicated, and no one's got an obvious and open solution to this. And I think there are fair arguments on both sides here. And I think what we'll need is just more open discussion between tech companies and the governments and the sort of electorate. They will come to agreements, I think. There are already very good things being done. For example, Google have developed an algorithm which redirects people who are on YouTube using sort of adware software to if you're looking at IS material on YouTube or extremist material on YouTube, your suggested videos or you'll be suggested links for videos that are fighting against that ideology. They are doing things and they have teams of people committed to this. So what we'll have to see is, the limit to which they're willing to go to please the government and the wider population.
Well, we're writing a new book here, and I believe you're doing just that, are you not?
I am writing a book, yes, on Anwar al-Awlaki, who was one of the first American jihadist preachers to really make use of the internet as a mobilizing and recruitment tool.
Dr. Alexander Milligrew-Hitchens is research director of the program on extremism at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C. Dr. Hitchens, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Andrew, what do you think? I mean, I put feelers out and questions out to Facebook, to Twitter, a few other. I got nothing back. Nothing whatsoever.
They
don't want to talk about it.
I'm not surprised. They don't, because this is such a gray area. And as Dr. Hitchens talked about, there's a lot of question marks. There's a lot of legal battles that are going to be going on, that are already going on, and the more that will be happening in the future. Lots of questions about what Prime Minister May wants to do exactly with social media. Now, the European Union has already been working with social media companies to stop hate speech and hate videos. Not clear if that applies to Britain now with the Brexit proceedings, if they can form their own deal with social media companies, if they'll take a more aggressive stance. And then it's, again, those legal battles, whether there's free speech versus terrorism information, those back and forth. Where do you draw those lines? So that's a lot of what's going on.
Where are people standing, basically, on this question?
All over the place. As diverse as the population of the world is, and as diverse as the population of social media, that's what we're seeing. People saying that you need to go after these terrorists where they are, which is social media. People on the other side very concerned about liberties and free speech. But it is this back and forth. It's something I've been reporting on in a video series that people can find at #VOA on Twitter and Facebook, talking about some of these social media implications and some of the connections to President Trump, because as we saw this weekend after the attack, he tweeted out and said we have to be less politically correct, and now he's calling his immigration ban a travel ban. So it seems like it's bleeding over into some policy areas as well.
We're, as I just said, opening a new book on this thing. There's a lot to be said.
Absolutely.
That is Andrew Palczewski right here on International Edition. Another big story that's happening is that Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt each announced Monday the cutting of diplomatic ties with Qatar, accusing it of supporting terrorism. These countries made the separate moves in short succession, saying they would withdraw their diplomatic staff from Qatar and cut air and sea traffic to the country. Airlines in the region, including Saudi, Emirates, and Etihad, all said they would halt flights to Qatar, while Qatar Airways announced a suspension of flights to Saudi Arabia. Yemen later joined in cutting off relations with Qatar. Speaking from a diplomatic mission in Sydney, Australia, with Defense Secretary James Mattis, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson urged the nations to keep communications open.
We certainly would encourage the parties to sit down together and address these differences. And if there's any role that we can play in terms of helping them address those, we think it is important that the GCC remain unified. I do not expect that this will have any significant impact, if any impact at all, on the unified fight against terrorism in the region.
Saudi Arabia, which leads a coalition of nations fighting in support of Yemen's government, also said Qatar's forces would be withdrawn from that fight. The Saudi state-owned SBA news agency said Qatar embraces multiple terrorist and sectarian groups aimed at disturbing stability in the region, including the Muslim Brotherhood, ISIS, and Al-Qaeda, and promotes the message and schemes of these groups through their media constantly. Qatar's Foreign Affairs Ministry said the measures are unjustified and they're based on baseless and unfounded allegations. And that is another story we are checking out. Another one deals with comedian Bill Cosby. His defense lawyer is diving straight in to attack the accuser of alleged inconsistencies in her statements to police as the actor's and comedian's sex assault trial opens in suburban Philadelphia. Defense lawyer Brian McMonagle says that accuser Andrea Constand first told police that they had never spoken after the encounter and that she had changed the date from mid-March to mid-January of 2004. McMonagle says that phone records show the two spoke 72 times after mid-January and two-thirds of the calls were initiated by Constand. McMonagle says Cosby and Constand had sipped drinks by a fire and had other romantic encounters. He says Cosby also hoped to help her rethink her career. You've been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Our thanks to Director Patrice Martin, our engineer Dan Crafton. I'm Ira Melma in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the world's most promising and, in terms of economy, fastest-growing regions, sub-Saharan Africa, is under attack by transnational criminal networks. Corruption is one of their major weapons. Corruption is an abuse of power at every level that impacts rich and poor countries alike in both the private and public sectors. Corruption destroys trust, undermines development, and erodes confidence in democratic institutions. It distorts markets, causes higher prices, discourages investors, and stunts economic growth. And it is particularly destructive to communities in developing countries, where it blocks development and progress. As the criminal networks see it, you must spend money to make money, and that goes double for corruption. And transnational crime is tremendously lucrative, accounting for 8 to 15% of the world gross domestic product. Hundreds of millions of dollars every year enable criminals and other threat networks to corrupt the regional economies and the global financial system, said Senior Director for National Security and Diplomacy Anti-Crime Programs at the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, David Luna.
The proceeds of drug trafficking and other forms of illicit trafficking are fueling a dramatic increase in corruption among the very institution responsible for fighting crime. The collusion and complicity of some government officials with criminal networks have helped to carve out an illicit trafficking corridor that stretches from West Africa coast to the Horn of Africa, from North Africa south to the Gulf of Guinea.
Across these illicit routes, bad actors and networks are corrupting critical institutions and enforcement systems that endanger everyone's security, said David Luna. The United States is determined, in cooperation with our partners in Africa, to disrupt and dismantle transnational organized crime networks. In support of President Donald Trump's executive order on transnational criminal organizations, the United States will continue to assist our partners to strengthen their capabilities to combat today's threat networks, said Mr. Luna. We must crack down on corruption at all levels and cut off the ability of kleptocrats, criminals, and terrorists to enjoy the fruits of illicit enterprise and that enable the financial capacity to execute their operations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.